Well, I just want to thank you very much for the invitation to be here, and what a lovely thing it is to be in Tasmania again, and particularly on a sunny winter's day like today. It's just utterly glorious, and I'm very much looking forward to sharing with you some of the insight and wisdom of Ecclesiastes, which actually applies pretty well to a context and a day like today. I think it's an ancient book, very ancient book. It feels a little out of place in the Bible in some ways. I think that's part of its intrigue. And yet at the same time, it speaks with a very contemporary voice and has astonishing, I think, very powerful relevance for our own day and age. I mentioned that my parents came to Australia as immigrants. They worked very hard in life. My father arrived without even the language under his belt, and after getting married, they raised two children, which took 5 years to conceive. 5 long years, as you can imagine. They married quite old, at least relative to the time. They got to the age of 65 with substantial assets under their belt. They'd worked very hard in their lives, and essentially, and this is now 25 years ago, were millionaires. They had two adult children who hadn't disgraced themselves yet entirely. And in every way, you'd think that they were just set for a smooth cruise home. And then came a sequence of bad decisions over the next 10 years that left them basically broke, separated, ultimately divorced, and in my dad's case, relatively estranged from his kids and grandkids since he moved to the other side of the planet. An acquaintance of mine is, if the truth be told, an idiot, what the Bible calls a fool. He is utterly rigid in his own views to the point where anyone who disagrees with him is by definition wrong, because if they were right, then they would by definition agree with him. He wanders through life like a bull in a china shop, with no idea of the amount of damage that he causes to people. And yet, in his church, he's highly respected, even awed as something of a pillar, and actually has a significant spiritual influence for good in the lives of many people. Another acquaintance of mine, the most intelligent person I have ever known, is also amongst the most relationally incompetent people I've ever known, and has spent the good part of his life desperately lonely. Now, I could tell you 100 stories like this, stories that illustrate the fact that so often life just doesn't make sense. And what's more, I'm sure that each of us here today could add our own 100 stories on top of that. Welcome to the world of the teacher. Or if you look in the footnote to your Bible, I suspect, at that first verse of the book of Ecclesiastes, you'll find out that literally the person is called Kohelet. The persona at the centre of this, I suggest, most disturbing book of the Bible. Ecclesiastes raises the fears and the doubts that we prefer to push to the side, and forces us to face the dark side, to see, but not just to really see, to feel how life promises so much and yet often delivers so little. That it seems to head down predictable paths, but then takes sideways turns that throw us right off balance, raises our hopes and then throws them back at us, laughing in our faces. Ecclesiastes does this in a very particular, very challenging way. In a sense, there are more questions than answers in this book. And so today might prove to be a little unsatisfying or even unsettling to you. Or at least, perhaps to put it more precisely, Ecclesiastes asks questions of such pointedness and pokiness that it simply won't let us get away with pat, easy answers. Kohelet pushes the boundaries of our thought because he knows that so often we don't have the spiritual or the intellectual courage to go there by ourselves. He's going to help us. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Kohelet is not so much a preacher like the Apostle Paul, for example, writing a letter to instruct and encourage. Rather, Ecclesiastes is more like a courtroom barrister interrogating our current answers to the challenges of life. Our plan of attack as we engage with this teacher, this barrister, is as follows. This first talk before morning tea is really the big picture, introducing the book as a whole. And in particular, I'm going to suggest that there are two ways to read Ecclesiastes, one that's a little more comforting, the other one that's a little more complex. And not surprisingly, perhaps you'll hear me suggesting that the more comforting way to read Ecclesiastes is probably not the best way to read it. That we Christians can sometimes blunt the pretty uncompromising message of Ecclesiastes. The second talk will look at one of the key issues in Ecclesiastes, the desperate yearning that we all have for justice and the right use of power rather than the abuse of power. And that is an issue of which we are all, I think, more and more aware in our society at the moment. And we'll see how and why the teacher challenges the meaning and significance of even this most precious thing, justice. And we'll conclude looking at how Ecclesiastes speaks of God and what difference he makes to the book's message. It's as I say, something of a scary ride, Ecclesiastes. A friend of mine likens it to being grabbed by the scruff of the neck and slammed up against the window of life. Nose pressed flat and slightly tear to the eyes manner. Being made to witness life in all of its contrariness and contradiction. It's sobering, but it's also very significantly an inoculation. You see, life is contrary and contradictory. And when we run into those things, if we're not ready, if our faith is shallow or brittle, if in the end we have nothing in our kit bag except a little bit of naive optimism, then we'll be shaken to the core and often simply broken in two. Of all people, Christians ought to be those who can face and deal with, for example, suffering in life best of all. After all, we serve a crucified Messiah. Suffering is engraved on his hands. His suffering is our salvation, and he calls all who would follow after him to, yes, you know, deny themselves and to take up their cross and follow him. We ought to know of all people how to suffer. But so often suffering doesn't produce endurance, and endurance character, and character hope, as the apostle puts it. It just produces bitterness and resignation and perhaps even ultimately unbelief. Of all people, Christians ought to know that wealth is seductive to the soul, but utterly incapable of delivering what it promises, and yet so often Christians are far less content, far less frugal, far less generous than we have reason to be. Naive, brittle faith will leave us vulnerable. And Ecclesiastes gives us a small dose of spiritual flu up front. And as we wrestle with Kohelet, we may get the shakes. But sometimes you've got to be cruel to be kind. And the end result of a close encounter of the Ecclesiastes kind is deeper, richer, more stable discipleship to Jesus Christ. So, that's the plan. You've been warned. Let's see what he has for us. Chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the teacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Verse 1 is presumably penned by an editor, because he speaks about the teacher from a third-person perspective. He introduces what follows this editor as written by an unnamed but identified figure. It says, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, two things about that. Firstly, David's son was, of course, Solomon, the figure renowned in the Bible as the wisest person ever, whose wealth matched his wisdom. And as chapter 2 unfolds, we won't look at that specifically today, but if you have a chance to read through the book of Ecclesiastes and go on the full journey, you'll see that the teacher goes on the wildest ride of them all, and it makes sense that he's very wealthy because he needs it to do all the things that he does. However, if it really was Solomon as such personally who wrote the book, it's almost certain that the editor would have said so. And so what most scholars agree is that what we have here is a persona. Someone's thought presented as that of Solomon and therefore presented as being as wise as Solomon. And the teacher wastes no time, unlike my long and windy introduction. The teacher announces the theme that will dominate the entire book, bringing a unity to these 12 chapters of otherwise somewhat meandering reflections on a sequence of barely related topics. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. All is vanity. There you go. Actually, if that's all you read, you've pretty much got the message of Ecclesiastes right there. That is the single point that Ecclesiastes explores with a razor-sharp gaze. And so right from the start, it's crucial to get a sense of what he means by this word, vanity, or in the Hebrew, it's hevel. I guess I'm going to teach you two Hebrew words today. They're the only two I know. Having done Hebrew six times, I used to do it once every semester. I would learn it for the exam and then forget it over the holidays, and then learn it for the next semester exam and then forget it over the holidays. So six times I've learned it and six times I've forgotten it. But hevel is one of the words I remember. The translation that we have here is vanity. Vanity is normally means what you do, for example, if you're a young man at the gym and you spend more time looking in the mirror than concentrating on lifting the weights that you're supposed to be lifting. I'm not a young man at the gym anymore. I'm a middle-aged man. I hate saying that, but it's true. I'm a middle-aged man. There you go. I'm just going to embrace. I'm a middle-aged man at the gym, and so I don't do that anymore. That's just in my imagination. I'm mature. Thank you. Well said. I used to be able to remove all my grey hair by a haircut, but that's not the case anymore. It's the old-fashioned sense, not that sort of vain sense. It's the old-fashioned sense of the word that's meant here. Vanity in the sense of futile or worthless or trivial or a waste of time. The basic sense of the word hevel is vapor or breath, what I'm doing now. And so you can see how you get from there to vanity. See, words, they just fly out and fly around. They disappear out of your mouth and their air waves go off and then they're gone. And in fact, the Bible uses it in that way from time to time. You've made my days a few hand breaths and my lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely everyone stands as mere breath, mere hevel. The emphasis is on temporariness. Human life as ephemeral or passing. Or the same point, perhaps a little more specific, something for all of us to take note of. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting. Beauty is hevel. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Now, and this is really important, what usually goes along with this sense of hevel as vanity is the phrase that appears in verse 2, under the sun. Under the sun. And the way Ecclesiastes is often taken is to put those two things together and to kind of produce a message out of it. And it goes like this. Life under the sun, that is, life understood as apart from God, life lived in an entirely material, godless way, or put into a New Testament context, life that doesn't know Jesus Christ, life as a non-Christian, okay? Life under the sun is vanity. Life under the sun like that is a breath, is worthless or trivial. But, this reading goes, but life lived with God, life lived as the book of Ecclesiastes concludes, fearing God and keeping his commandments, that life is not vanity. That life is not worthless. I even have a friend who takes that sequence of thought one step further and holds that since the only thing that really lasts into eternity and is not vaporous is Christian ministry, really the only thing that escapes the condemnation of the teacher that all is vanity is the doing of Christian ministry. And therefore, as he put it, give up your day job. In other words, on this reading, you see, the whole of Ecclesiastes functions as a kind of the bad news story about being a non-Christian that comes before the good news story about being a Christian. But really has nothing much to say to us about the living of the Christian life. It's the past. It's where we've come from. Now, I'm suggesting to you that that is a comforting way to read Ecclesiastes. It's a story that makes some degree of sense, actually, that way of seeing things. But it just doesn't wash with the text. The problem with it is simply that God doesn't wait till the end of Ecclesiastes to make an appearance. God doesn't wait till the end of Ecclesiastes to reassure us that when he's at the centre of our picture, everything is okay. That somehow with God, everything is not vanity. No, 39 times throughout Ecclesiastes, God is mentioned fair and square in the middle of life under the sun. Right there, in the middle of life under the sun. God is present, and still the teacher can say, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, I think a better sense of what the teacher's getting at by this key word, hevel, is a combination of fleeting, but also the idea of being elusive, something that you just can't quite get your hands on. At the end of chapter 1, in verse 17, the teacher uses a parallel phrase to describe the same thing. He says it's a chasing after wind, or more literally, a shepherding of the wind. I've, from time to time, tried to shepherd sheep, get them all moving at the same time in the same direction. And that's hard enough. I have three Labradors, and taking them out for a walk is an exercise in futility. Trying to get them back in the car at the right point in time, that's nuts. But that's nothing on trying to shepherd wind, is it? Imagine actually setting yourself the task. The wind, I believe, might come through this afternoon. That's not an uncommon experience. It will rise. And we should, if it does, we should have a collective kind of lived experience of Ecclesiastes and all go out and try and shepherd the wind together. Get it to sort of go in this direction rather than that direction. It would be kind of rough, really, wouldn't it? I mean, you'd hate to spend your whole life doing that. It's a crazy task. Wind is just something that refuses to be shepherded. You can't wrestle it to the ground and get it under control. We just don't have that capacity. It's above your pay grade. ephemeral, elusive. That's what life is like, according to the teacher. Perhaps the best word that we could use to translate Havel is absurd. The key thought in the idea of the absurd is that there are two things that are linked together, or at least ought to be linked together. Everything tells you that they should be linked together, but they're not. The link is broken down. Hard work ought to produce good results, but so often it doesn't. When I was in university in my second year, I was studying law, and a particular subject, contract law. I loved contracts. I read every required reading case. I read every recommended reading case. I wrote summaries of this subject, which became classics in the field, passed down from generation to generation of Evangelical Union law students. I knew everything there was to know about contracts. And in the exam, I got 71%. Mr. 71. I saw a friend who had hardly turned up to a lecture, but he had gotten a copy of my notes. And he was driving in the opposite direction one time. We just sort of passed each other on the road. It was one of those really strange moments, the day that the exam results were published. And it was summer, our windows were down, and I shouted through the window, "How'd you go in contracts?" He said, "75%. I drove on. That's absurdity. It's absurd that wisdom ought to produce a better outcome than being a fool. But both the wise and the foolish meet the same end, to be mourned by their friends at a funeral service. It's absurd that pleasure is by definition better than pain, but it hardly satisfies any more than just a moment. It's absurd that really lovely, beautiful people, kind, generous, warm, somehow can't make relationships work and end up all too lonely. Hear this loud and clear. It's Kohelet is not saying that these things and more broadly everything is absurd in the sense that it's merely incongruous or ironic. That's too light. No, it's oppressive, even tragic. I joke about contract law exams, of course, for the single reason that it's easy to just brush off. But no, Kohelet says all the things that matter in life are like this as well. In the same way, he's not saying that life is mysterious or incomprehensible. That implies that if only we were smarter, if only we worked just a little bit harder, and I'll come back to this towards the end of the talk, if only we just had a little more insight, then we could figure things out. And the teacher's not even saying that things are meaningless, strictly. No, on the contrary. Throughout Ecclesiastes, things can have meaning in and of themselves. The teacher's very happy to say that some things are better than others. On the contrary, what the teacher says is not that he doesn't understand. He understands all right. He understands that these things just are irrational, that the world is warped. We live in a world that we can neither fully understand nor fully control. In fact, most of the time, our understanding and our control are massively limited. And the reason that it's absurd, that the reason that he says it's absurd, is precisely because he refuses to give up on either one of his fundamental convictions. See, on the one hand, Ecclesiastes is perfectly convinced that God is in charge of all things. And he will not let go of that. And on the other hand, he recognizes with full honesty that things are bad, or at least sometimes bad, and confusing, and ungraspable, and vaporous, and he's not going to pretend otherwise. Less courageous thinkers let go of one pole or the other, you see. The teacher holds on to both and draws his conclusion. Havel. Havel. Everything is Havel. Which leads to point two, that the biggest complaint of all is that there's no ultimate advantage in anything. Verse 3, what do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? This is the second Hebrew word for the day. Remember, havel, that's the first one, absurd. The second word is yitron, profit. And profit, yitron, is a key to the teacher's understanding of the absurdity of life. Yitron is concerned with the surplus on investment. Yitron is what's left over after you've paid all the debts and all the obligations that you have. 13 years ago, my wife started a veterinary business with a colleague. She suffered what they call in the literature an entrepreneurial seizure. She decided that she didn't like working for someone else, and so she was going to start up her own vet business, and it would be the perfect vet business. They each worked about 30 hours, her and her business colleague, and they didn't draw a salary after the business opened for 5 months, and for the first 3 years, the least trained vet nurse earned more than they did. If any of you are small business people, you're feeling me here. They gained no yitron, no profit from all their toil. Even if they got a modest salary enough to pay the rent, then there would still be no yitron, just the treadmill of a workaday job. And what the teacher says is that there's no yitron, there's no real advantage, no strides forward in life as a whole. That when you've done all your work and you've invested in all your relationships and you've done all your activity, what difference ultimately has it all made? You might ask that question about a specific meeting, if you still go to meetings. Some people have given up on meetings altogether. And afterwards you say, was that really the very finest use of my 2 hours of time that I could have spent there? You might ask that question about a specific meeting or about a day or a week or a project, but Kohelet says, ask that question about the whole of your life. And you see, that's why it's absurd, because everything in us screams out to say, there ought to be yitron. It ought to make a difference. Or at least that's what humanism says, isn't it? Humanism is one of the great ideologies of our time, a kind of grand attempt to create meaning in life after you've announced that God is dead. And the humanist approach is to say that the meaning of life is to make a difference, to make a contribution, perhaps on the big stage or perhaps just in the smaller circle of your family and friends. And Kohelet says it just doesn't stack up. The first example he uses is the biggest example of them all, the created order in its entirety. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Human generations come and go, but this procession of life doesn't really alter the face of humanity. Enormous effort, no result, no yitron. Death still gets pretty much 100.0% of us. It's much the same thing with the natural elements. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and then goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. I mean, it's just so beautiful, isn't it? Such, yeah, good point, actually, now that you think about it. And to the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow. The sun rising and setting in east and west, the wind blowing in north and south, the water systems of precipitation and evaporation, all of them achieve nothing. They're simply the repeating of a cycle without any real progress. And for the teacher, this is not a comforting thing, the way being at the beach and seeing the waves come in and out is the same beautiful crash and foaming of the surf. That's the Buddhist way, actually. The eternal sameness of all things is a deep truth to be embraced and eventually to be ourselves absorbed into. That's what Buddhism says. Not for the teacher. Right? That would be to let go of one pole. Now, the teacher's reaction is one of protest. There is no yitron, no profit, and there should be, verse 8, all things are wearisome. Or perhaps all things are hard at work, which is a better translation and makes, I think, a little more sense in the context. Yes, all these things are hard at work, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them. What's more, this is not just the lazy conclusion of someone who can't be bothered with actually working hard. Verse 12, I, the teacher, when king over Israel in Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. This is a person of hugely deep reflection and investigation. There's no laziness here. There's no just burying head in the sand and pretending. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun and see all is vanity and a chasing after wind. Kohelet says he's undertaken a universal investigation, one that encompasses all that is done under heaven, and to have searched it all out by wisdom. And still his conclusion is the same. All is vanity. All is absurd. It just doesn't work. It's a chasing, a shepherding of the wind. As the proverb puts it, verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And then a few chapters later, the teacher makes it clear how he understands this. This is chapter 7, verse 13. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? You see the teacher's point? The way the world is, this crookedness, this impossibility, this lack, which is the opposite of yitron, profit, this deficit, the thing that's missing, is nothing less than the work of God. You see why you can't say that under the sun is apart from God? No, it's the work of God. It's He who has given human beings their unfortunate business in life to be busy with. And so his conclusion, verse 16, I said to myself, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a chasing after wind, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. When our first child, Miles, was a baby, he cried a lot. Now, I know all parents think that their babies cry a lot, but mine really cried a lot. He cried all night, and then he cried all day. And a friend of ours used to say that he cried a lot because he was a thinker baby, and that this was supposed to be encouragement to us, that he was a thinker. There were some dumb babies that weren't happy, but ours was a thinker baby, and that's why he cried a lot. And after that, as I say, we realised there were two types of kids. There were thinker babies like ours and dumb ones. And the teacher says, actually, that's pretty much how it is throughout life. In much wisdom, if you're going to be a thinker adult, well, there's a lot of vexation. You'll cry a lot. And those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. Of course, there's an alternative to that, which is if you can stay busy enough, you can just keep so active that you never have enough time to think or reflect. You just bounce from one kind of frenetic activity to the next, then you'll never get to where the teacher gets to. You just be tired. And Kohelet says, I don't want to let you get away with that. Walk with me here a little. Stop. Think. Because the truth is that the more you understand life, the deeper your insight, the better and more accurate your observation, the more compelling is the conclusion, verse 14, I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and see, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. All right, let's draw the threads of this introduction together. I told you it was going to be an interesting journey. There is another ancient Israelite book that's not in the Bible. Confusingly, it's called Ecclesiasticus. Okay, so that's not in the Bible, but it's another ancient Israelite book. It's a much happier book. It's confident that everything works out in the end. Its final words are, may your soul rejoice in God's mercy, and may you never be ashamed to praise him. Do your work in good time, and in his own time, God will give you your reward. Now, that sounds a lot better, doesn't it? That's the sort of thing the Bible should say. But do you know what? The interesting thing is that neither the church nor the synagogue, actually, decided to include Ecclesiasticus in their scriptures and instead went for Ecclesiastes in all its darkness and contradictions. And that's because it speaks the truth about life, not all of life so much as life taken as a whole. The teacher will go on to say two crucial things about this collapse of meaning, two things which function to give him and us the strength to hold on to both of those convictions, both poles, that God is God and good, and that life is often bad. On the one hand, he says, this collapse of meaning into the absurd is not the whole story, for God allows us to build small meanings from the broken pieces of reason and experience. These small things, usually termed by the teacher as pleasures, the local pleasures of work and relationships and life's small joys, don't rescue the big picture, but they do operate within it, and they are the gift of God, and we're to receive them as such, the meals and the conversations and the tears with friends. Those magic sporting moments, the spectacular journeys, these are all good things. Not grandly meaningful, but good. And the teacher says, enjoy them from God. And on the other hand, the very fact of the collapse of meaning is utterly insisted upon by the teacher as not somehow apart from the purposes of God. It's what God intends. For after it comes fear. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Okay, I think we'll stop there. We need, I think, a bit of a break to recharge. That's enough to kind of swallow in one sitting. I've got a cultural reflection that I was going to finish with, but I think I'll begin with that next time. So we head to a break, is that right, at this point in time? Head to a break. I'll see you in about 25 minutes. Yep.